from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Born in Brooklyn in 1930, Norman Podhoretz was raised the son of Jewish immigrants. He was tough, tenacious. He joined a gang, the Club Cherokee, and said that in the 1940s, he learned never to back down in a fight. As a young man, he took that hard-nosed will, matched it with a towering intellect, and quickly became one of America's most influential public thinkers. He started liberal, then turned 60s radical, and then broke ranks with the country's liberal intelligentsia to become a founding intellectual force behind American neoconservatism. It was a very public evolution, and a powerful one. The worldview he described in fierce, fine, virile prose over decades as editor of Commentary magazine is now the worldview many Americans inhabit, not least in George W. Bush's Washington. Clarity is courage, he wrote. It also turns out to be extremely persuasive. Tonight on Point, founding father of American neoconservatism, Norman Podhoretz. What's your question for this prime mover of American neoconservatism? Have you been following neoconservatism since the 70s, or has it come to you recently via Pearl, Wolfowitz, and Rumsfeld? How does the neocon age look to you so far? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Norman Podhoretz, author of many celebrated books such as Making It and Breaking Ranks, and editor of Commentary magazine for 35 years from 1960 to 1995. An anthology of his writing from the 1950s to the 1990s has just been released, entitled The Norman Podhoretz Reader, edited by Thomas Jeffers, and it is a terrific collection. Good evening and welcome, Norman Podhoretz.
Good evening. Thank you, and thank you for that flattering introduction.
Well, more than well-deserved. It's terrific to have you with us tonight. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point's news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Mr. Podhoretz.
Hi.
Norman Podhoretz, looking back over these essays, as I've had the pleasure of doing over the last couple of days, it's just an incredible span, and a tip of the hat to Thomas Jeffers. He's done a wonderful job editing and introducing the many and quite distinctive phases of your intellectual life. So here we are sitting tonight. If the internet tells me correctly, tomorrow is your 74th birthday.
Well, that's you're certainly on point. Yes, it
okay.
is.
So an early happy birthday, and gosh, what a journey it must appear to be, and what a kind of satisfying moment I've got to think for you, for whom neoconservatism is not something new out of the headlines of 2003 or 4, but a very old idea and passion. To see how it's come to be more or less the commanding view of Washington in this time.
Yeah, well, you know, I've been a neoconservative for so long that I sometimes think I should be called a paleo-neoconservative. when I first became what was known as a neoconservative, it was new. That's what neo means, mm-hmm. new conservative. Mm-hmm. And it also meant people who were new to conservatism, that is, the neoconservatives, were all people who began their political lives somewhere to the left of center and moved in a rightward direction, some further right than others. But oddly enough, in answer to your question, in 1995, I wrote an essay which is included in the Norman Podhoretz Reader, called Neoconservatism, a Eulogy, in which I argued that neoconservatism was dead, not in the sense that it no longer existed, but that it had moved in a rightward direction from the left, and many traditional conservatives, like those around the National Review, had moved in a leftward direction from the right, and we'd all met somewhere right of center, and therefore neoconservatism was no longer a distinctive phenomenon requiring a name of its own.
And no longer new, but something slipping into the mainstream.
That's right, and but it had also influenced the mainstream. The mainstream was affected. In any event, I was very surprised when the term was resurrected, and I've been bemused by the popularity of it. It's now all over the world, the term neoconservative, neocon.
It's everywhere. It abbreviates nicely. It speaks to a whole time and a whole coterie. Norman Podhoretz, we want to ask a favor of you tonight. Mm-hmm. And that is this. We have spoken with any number of neocons in the thick of government right now,
right.
In the thick of advising. And I don't mean to suggest by any means that you are not influential in that realm.
Well,
but
certainly not in the thick of government.
Not in the thick. And, you know, very often these conversations can become very contentious. Because people are in the middle of things that are happening, wars going on, and all the rest. I am hoping that you will step back with us a little tonight from your august nearly 74 years and help us sort of take a journey through the evolution of the American sort of political philosophy, the dominant cultural frame of these decades that are outlined in the New Reader.
I would be glad to do that. Yes.
Because it's absolutely fascinating to see how you changed, how the country's changed. I want to get your sense of where it stands tonight, but maybe a good place to begin is, and I'm not sure who you applied this phrase to, but I think it was yourself when you said that after your years as a liberal and as a 60s radical in the early 60s, that reality mugged you. It turned you to a neoconservative. Let me ask you just for starters, what was the reality that mugged you, Norman Porthoretz?
Well, I don't remember using that phrase. Irving Kristol, the real founding father of neoconservatism, I suppose, it said that a neoconservative was a liberal who'd been mugged by reality.
I guess maybe you just picked it up in the Reader and applied it to some of the folks you were looking at.
Yeah,
were you one of those? Were you mugged by reality, and what reality?
Well, my evolution was somewhat different from Irving Kristol's and the other early neoconservatives. What happened to me, really, in the mid to late 60s, was a revulsion against the spread of anti-Americanism within the general community of the left. And I mean anti-Americanism, I mean hatred of this country, contempt for this country. The idea was being propagated that this country was not only evil in itself and irreparable beyond reform, but was the cause of evil in the world at large. And it was not just radicals who were saying that. Mainstream liberals like Anthony Lewis, columnist of the New York Times, actually said the United States was the greatest menace, or words to that effect, to the peace of the world to the world in general. Even as a radical, even at my most radical, I never hated this country. My view was I'm a recovering utopian, I like to call myself. I was afflicted by the utopian disease, and I thought it was possible to perfect life on Earth and life in this country.
That is before you became neocon.
Utopianism is not one of the constituent elements of the neoconservative worldview, to put it mildly.
So take us, if you would, what then for you, what is the crux, what is the heart of neoconservatism? It gets a lot of easy usage today.
Yeah.
But
well,
as you, from a sort of higher intellectual vantage look at it, how would you describe the crux of it?
Well, the trouble is that term is now used in a way that differs from its precise or original meaning. Anyway, neoconservatism was never a movement. It was
a
tendency.
Mm-hmm.
And a good many individuals, most of them operating as individuals, not in consort or in in any kind of organized form, began recoiling from the dominant liberal or left culture of the mid and late 60s. And in my case, the real issue was this country. Was this country on the whole good or bad? Was it a force for good or a force for evil? As I was trying to say before, mm-hmm. I never hated this country. I always loved this country, even at my most radical. And when friends of mine and comrades in arms, ideological or political comrades in arms, began talking in terms that I found not only false but quite disgusting, really, comparing this country to Nazi Germany, because that's become commonplace now. But it was unbelievably shocking 35 years ago. And when I began hearing that and listening to the tone of the discussion of this country in the mid-60s, I more and more found myself unable to live with such attitudes and surrounded by such attitudes. Other neoconservatives were reacting to different currents in the culture of the 60s, but this was the central one for me. And in the end, I think it was the central one that shaped neoconservatism. I once said that if I'd had my way, I would have called this tendency neo-nationalism rather than neoconservatism, because what it amounted to was a commitment to the idea that the United States of America was not only not an evil society, but a good one and a force for good in the world, and that it had a responsibility for exercising its power protection of liberal democracy.
Mm-hmm. And you may have preferred to call it neo-nationalism. And clearly, throughout your work, I've just been looking over, there are many references to this point. But there's a what I had thought was a kind of deeper line of thinking as well that went beyond national boundaries, national character, to this whole issue of reality itself, and as I read you, accepting reality as it is.
Well, I see what you mean. Sure.
Take us into that.
Well, that's the anti-utopian element that I was alluding to a little earlier. The idea that that life is what we find it in the present. To judge it by standards by absolute standards. Leads one into not only personal difficulties, but intellectual and political misrepresentations and false expectations and false standards. The point was that there is such a thing as a universal human nature. There is such a thing as moral standards that have to be understood in the terms of the world in which one lives and in terms of the person one is. It's very hard for me to describe this vividly in the abstract, because these statements sound like, you know, banalities.
Well, they sound anything but banal when you write them. And one of the words that you resurrect very vigorously is evil, saying this is part of reality that can't be ignored.
Well,
a word that's very popular and much in usage now.
I mean, I'm Jewish, and as a Jew, I've never believed in the doctrine of original sin, but my general view of reality comes close to something like what the doctrine of original sin suggests in its non-theological modality. That is, that there is such a thing as evil in the human soul and in the world, and that it will always be there. What I don't believe is that it's inherited from, you know, from parents to children. But leaving that point aside, the persistence of evil and the need to deal with it and grapple with it, both within the individual soul and in the world at large, is a truth that, I would say all conservatives, not just neoconservatives, deeply believe.
Jack Beatty, we've asked you along for the ride tonight, and I know that on many fronts you come down on a different side from Norman Podhoretz, but you can't help but see his influence, his impact in the world we live in right now.
A singular career. His mentor, Lionel Trilling, wrote in 1950 that conservatism had no ideas, only, quote, irritable mental gestures. And by that, he was, of course, referring to the Goldwater movement, or what became the Goldwater movement, which was a kind of nationalism, but fairly primitive. Well, Norman Podhoretz supplied that lack. I mean, no one would say that conservatism today didn't have ideas. Indeed, from A to Z, it has an armory of ideas. It's a kind of ideological totalism. And this is a remarkable, if not singular, achievement for a writer to have, to really re-endow a political party with this kind of power and to have influence on events.
We're talking tonight with Norman Podhoretz, one of America's most influential intellectuals, the godfather of neoconservatism. You can join the conversation. What's your question for the prime mover of the neoconservative tendency? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with the godfather of neoconservatism, longtime editor of Commentary magazine, Norman Podhoretz. New book is out, The Norman Podhoretz Reader, of a selection of his writings from the 50s through the 90s, edited by Thomas Jeffers. And it is quite a tour of the evolution of one intellectual life and in and around that, the intellectual evolution, as it turns out, of a country. You can join our conversation tonight. Neoconservatives have said they are liberals mugged by reality. Have you been mugged into the neocon view? Are we living in the neocon age? How's it look so far? And what would a fully neocon America look like? Are we in it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Norman Podhoretz, yeah. I wonder how you'd speak to that. I mean, where do you see neoconservatism beyond your eulogy for it, but as it works and exists today, how do you see it? Where do you see it most prominently at work in the United States, in the world?
Well, what are generally now taken to be neoconservative ideas and policies are certainly very powerful in the foreign policy of the Bush administration, no question about that. I don't think that that neoconservatism has swept the culture generally. By culture, I mean the universities, the major media, the intellectual community at large. There is, as you might say, a redoubt of neoconservative intellectuals and neoconservative periodicals. Writers.
Do you think it will sweep the country, the culture? Is America cut out to be a neoconservative nation?
No, I don't think it will sweep the country, but I think it will continue, I suspect it will continue to dominate the political culture of this country.
And why is that if it doesn't dominate a broader culture?
Well, the political culture operates in terms of numbers, and the world of ideas is not a phenomenon shaped by numbers. If you subject certain ideas and policies to a vote, as we do in the political realm, I think the ideas that are associated with neoconservatism these days are winning.
But is there a split personality then going on nationally if it's winning politically but not sweeping culturally? Yeah. How can that bifurcation go on?
Well, we've been living with it for a while now. I suspect that most Americans sort of mind their own business. They live their lives from day to day. They pay attention to their jobs, their families, sports. Anything they happen to be interested in.
And are they neocons as they do that or not?
Well, in a sense they are, because I think that people living their lives from day to day in what I would consider, more or less normal way, tend to be, in some generic sense, conservative. But that doesn't speak to the question of you raised about the bifurcation. I mean, you're in Boston, and I remember something Bill Buckley, William F. Buckley Jr., editor of National Review, once said that I like to quote. And he once said, "I'd rather be ruled by the first 2,000 names in the Boston phone book than by the combined faculties of Harvard and MIT." And what he was saying there, and I agree with it, is that the first 2,000 names in the Boston phone book, meaning, of course, most people, have shown greater sense and even wisdom in our time than the intellectual elites have shown.
And what about the intellectual elites of the Bush administration? Do you think Buckley would choose the first 2,000 names of a phone book over them?
Well, Buckley has, I think, his reservations about some of the people you're talking about, and I have to.
These are more the children of Podhoretz than of Buckley.
Well, they're not, or of Crystal, more than of Podhoretz. But in foreign policy, perhaps I could claim paternity, but But the point is, and it's a very important point to understand, that when intellectuals go into government, they cease operating as intellectuals. They become, they enter another realm in which other qualities are required of them to be successful.
But they sure do take their stripes and their worldview with them.
Well, sure, but they take a worldview with them and they try to act on it. But they're not operating as intellectuals any longer. I mean, they're executing policy, which is a different art, or if you like, a different modus vivendi.
And yet, in every administration, we can feel some guiding ideology working, and working pretty strong in this one. Let me ask you on that front.
Yeah, that's true. And but what I would argue is that those ideas are they're usually less systematic than the word ideology implies. Those ideas are ideas that are sort of the capital with which government officials operate. I mean, it's the stuff they've accumulated in the past, even if they're not intellectuals.
Stepping off that notion, then, Noman Podhoretz, is Iraq the first neoconservative war?
Well, I don't know. Afghanistan may have been.
There seemed to be paleo-conservative support for Afghanistan, but less for Iraq. I mean,
well, not so much for Afghanistan either, but we don't have to quibble about that.
Yeah.
I see your point. I mean, I would say that the latter phase of the Cold War, beginning in the with the Reagan administration, but really beginning intellectually in the early 70s, was very much a neoconservative war. I mean, Ronald Reagan was himself a neoconservative, strictly speaking. He began as a Democrat, a liberal Democrat. Mm. He didn't become a Republican even until he was 51 years old. Mm-hmm. People don't realize that about him. And his worldview was very much influenced by the word neoconservative wasn't as widespread then as it has since become. But
that school, but the neocons didn't.
But
the neocons didn't start the Cold War. Iraq, I wonder if
right.
It's the first from.
Well, oddly enough, the Cold War really was started by the Soviet Union, but the policies that the United States followed in the Cold War were crafted by Democrats, not by Republicans, mm-hmm. by liberals, not by conservatives. There's been a complete sort of turnaround, change, switch of identities in our political culture, not just in foreign policy, but I think also on domestic affairs. That's itself a very interesting story about which I've written. And stuff I've had to say about that is in the Norman Podhoretz Reader.
Let me ask you on this front. Another thing that looks to me from all your writing here to be at the heart of what you're communicating is the embrace of self-interest, the embrace of the interest of oneself, one's, I don't know, family, community, people, country, unabashed embrace
yes.
of it.
Yes, wholehearted.
Wholehearted, which flies in the face of an awful lot of what we think of as liberal thinking, and maybe it flies in a lot of cultural thought as well. You wrote all the way back in a very early essay, or relatively early, My Negro Problem and Ours. You wrote, the tragic fact is that love is not the answer to hate. It seems somehow corollary to this embrace of interest to me. I wonder
yes.
how you
well,
look at that.
I'm very strong. I mean, it's something I've believed all throughout my intellectual life. The idea that the self-interest is benign, especially in the context of what Edmund Burke, one of the fathers of modern conservatism, called the little platoons, one's family, one's friend, one's neighborhood, and eventually one's country. You have to be attached to the little platoons in order to be capable of serious attachment to something larger that grows out of the little platoons. It's also the basis, I think, of the American constitutional political system. It's what Madison meant by in talking in the Federalist Papers about the importance of faction. He was worried about too much factionalism, but I think the genius of the American Constitution. I mean, one of the aspects of its genius was to find a way of accommodating and even harmonizing the clash of political self-interest.
But what
it
about
taken
what,
as a, it was taken as a given and not in itself, and in itself a good thing. Again, you go back to Adam Smith, who said, you know, I forget the exact quote. It's a very famous sentence where he said, "It's not out of altruism or love of his neighbor that the butcher provides you his meat. It's out of self-interest." And this is, this is what Smith saw as the guiding principle of a functioning, well-functioning economic system.
Jack Beattie, here we get right down to it, where Norman Podhoretz is not at all ready to sign up for the idea of the global citizen, as I read him. It's look out for yours and your own, and that collectively will add up to the best we can do, to the realistic best we can do, Jack. There's the big parting of ways in a lot of American thinking.
Well, yes, it's a very powerful and appealing idea, especially as it seems to sanction our impulses, our first impulses, which, of course, are inevitably to look after ourselves and secondarily the spillover of ourselves and our family and in our community. So it's a strong idea. But there are three other traditions in the West that make it seem morally problematic. One is the Christian. The central symbol of Christianity is self-sacrifice. It's a man on a cross giving up his life for humanity. And the Christian is enjoined to love the neighbor as himself, an impossibility, of course, but that's the ideal. And then the Kantian tradition is one where, again, our inclinations, the things that our interests, don't signify to him as moral. It's when we triumph over our interests, our inclinations, and do our duty that we are acting morally. And finally, the military tradition. You know, you read those obituaries and of the World War II guys, and it always says, you know, talking about how they got their decorations, it'll say, heedless of the risk to himself, Sergeant Jones charged the pillbox.
Into the curtain of lead.
Yeah, so that our very model of heroism is self-sacrifice.
Norman Podhoretz,
I would agree with what Jack Beattie said about the Christian and Kantian traditions, but we don't have time to discuss in detail the nuances and implications of those traditions and how they might be reconciled with what I'm talking about. But
I don't want to leave them entirely aside if we can, because this bifurcation we talked about earlier.
I want to get to heroism. I want to get to the military.
We'll come back then.
That'll give you some indication of what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. The truth of the matter is, as anyone who served in the military knows, the principle of self-interest is extremely, it's not only important, it's essential, because it's exactly the sort of thing I'm talking about. The little platoon, you are a member of a platoon, and you are and that's your family, and you're responsible for them, and they're responsible for you. And this is one of the and you're trained that way, and this is one of the ways in which people are indeed led to violate the basic law of self-preservation and endanger themselves or give up their lives for others, just as most parents would give up their lives for their children, because I don't know, there's a psychologist who called this something like narcissistic altruism.
You don't see it as self-sacrifice, but as a...
Well, it is self-sacrifice, but the self I'm talking about, as I said earlier, is not merely the individual. This is not radical individualism. On the contrary, the self I'm talking about includes one's family, one's community, and ultimately one's country. The point is that I wrote a book called The Prophets, about the Hebrew prophets, a couple of years ago, last year, and which I tried to show that the mentality of the prophets was based on an absolute inability or refusal to distinguish between the particular and the universal. Human beings could only arrive at the universal through the particular. And that idea is also central to the literary tradition out of which we come. I talk a lot about William Blake, who talked about eternity in a grain of sand.
But it seems to make idealism look kind of silly when you define it that way. Norman Podhoretz, on the 25th anniversary of your time as editor of Commentary, you gave a talk. I just want to read a little excerpt of it here. It's interesting. You said like so many of us, I was educated to believe that the last thing one ought to be defending was one's own, that it was more honorable and nobler to turn one's back on one's own and fight for others and for other things in which one had no personal stake or interest. This has been a very hard lesson to unlearn, and I am proud to have unlearned it. I have to say, it's clear in every essay after a certain point that you've written here. And yet, gosh, as a nation, that seems very, very central to an awful lot of American thinking.
Well, the truth is that people who have tried to follow the other path have done far more damage in the world, in my opinion, so-called idealists, than people who have been loyal to one's own.
And such as?
Most of the radical revolutionists from the Jacobins of the French Revolution through the communists and even the fascists were what we would call idealists. I mean, they were fighting for some universal ideal, and in the name of that universal ideal, they were willing to slaughter a great many people in order to bring what they saw as the truth and the perfection of the world into being. I myself think that the Anglo-American tradition, which is rooted in something like the kind of view I'm advocating, going all the way back to thinkers like Adam Smith and not Burke so much, although Burke, I could enlist him in that tradition too. But the 18th century empiricists, I think, is a far superior one, both morally and politically, to the tradition that comes from the other direction, out of Rousseau and the French encyclopedists.
Jack, we just got a minute before the break here, but let me pull you in. This is a big fork in the road. Ultimately, where do you see the United States settling here, culturally, politically? Do you see the neocon century opening up before us, or is this just a moment in the sun for this view?
Well, I think what Mr. Podhoretz says is right, that in our natural lives and sort of people's daily lives, they are conservatives. We all are. It sort of goes with much of life, and we live in an economy that even if we didn't want to,
enjoins us
from morning, noon, and night to think of ourselves and of getting ahead and of competing and so on. All that is true, and yet there's another tradition that says that's not enough, that you can't just sort of build a whole politics around that, because it leads an awful lot of people out, and that the real idea is to all go ahead together.
We're going to come back and talk more with Noam Podhoretz. You can join the conversation. Are we all neocons now? Are you ready to fight for yours, for your interests, without guilt? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with the godfather of American neoconservatism, Norman Podhoretz. He's out with a new collection of his writings from the 50s through the 90s, 40 years of his work.
50, actually.
50 years. We'll take that. The Norman Podhoretz Reader, edited by Thomas Jeffers. You can join our conversation tonight. Is the highest good to fight for your own, yourself, your people, your country? And what about selfless idealism? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Ailey's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Ailey, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have in front of me the Statement of Principles of the New American Century document from June 3rd, 1997.
This is the project, the group. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And there seems to be a contradiction in there. In the very last sentence, it mentions something about a policy of military strength and moral clarity may not be necessary today, but it is necessary if the United States is to build on the success of this past century and ensure our security and our greatness in the next.
And the contradiction you want to point
to? It seems to me that moral clarity is an aspect of idealism, which Mr. Podhoretz is criticizing.
Mm-hmm.
A pragmatist is aware of moral ambiguity. The other issue has to do with self-interest, and I think Mr. Podhoretz is referring to a concept of self-interest which was articulated in utilitarianism, but developed more fully by John Stuart Mill. Mm. And the problem with that is, how do we know what is in our best interest?
If we don't look to a higher ideal. Ailey, our time is short. Let me put that to Norman Podhoretz. How about it? This, can you have moral clarity if you can't have some idealism?
Well, depends what you mean by idealism. Certainly you can have moral clarity. I think moral clarity, I mean, is something I've strived to have all my life. And as you quoted something I said, clarity is courage. That's the point of it.
But courage is not necessarily moral.
Well, yes and no. Mm-hmm. It depends again on the context. But I see no contradiction between the desideratum of moral clarity and the point of view that I'm stressing. As for knowing what is in your self-interest, well, I would argue that most people, whether quote, ordinary people or not, pretty well know what's good for them, what's bad for them, almost by instinct, almost by animal instinct, if you like. And the fact is that the democratic theory is based on the assumption that all of us, each individual, knows best what is good for him. That is better than I know what's good for him, or than you know what's good for him.
But Ailey, we hear the critique in your question. I want to try and get one more caller before we run out of time here tonight. Thanks for your call. Patrick's on the line. Hi, Patrick. You're on the air.
Good evening. Thank you. Question for Mr. Podhoretz. I've read your book, Ex-Friends, and you've sort of split with more illustrious people than most of us ever get a chance to meet.
This is Lillian Hellman and Norman Mailer and
Norman
Allen Ginsberg
Mailer,
and all the rest.
Et cetera, yes. And I'm wondering, do you really believe it's impossible to remain friends with people with whom you disagree so violently?
Yeah, well, that's an excellent question that I address in the book, Ex-Friends, where I begin by saying that if I wish to name drop, I have only to list my ex-friends. And the book was written to illustrate that proposition.
And it's politics that you split over, and essentially their liberalism and your retreat from it.
Not just politics, because the politics in a much larger sense.
Political philosophy.
View of life, really. Mm-hmm. Look, if you don't take ideas with the kind of religious seriousness that many intellectuals do, then there's no reason why you can't be friends with someone with whom you disagree. He's a Republican, you're a Democrat, he's a liberal, you're a sort of conservative. These are not issues of life and death to you. But the kind of people I was talking about, and I include myself, do actually experience ideas, not just political ideas, even ideas about art, as matters almost literally of life and death, which means that if you have a friend with whom you used to be more or less in tune, and then you develop radical disagreements, you can only maintain the relation if at the cost of either not talking about what you both most care about, or fighting all the time. And so even if you don't have a nasty, contentious split, you find yourself drifting apart because either both of these alternatives are unpleasant.
Norman Podhoretz, I hate to interrupt, Patrick. Mm-hmm. Thanks for your call. We just got 20 seconds left here.
Sure.
Do you see neoconservatism now at a high watermark or much more running room?
Well, I think it's got more running room in the realm of foreign policy, less in domestic affairs. But that's a whole different question.
Perhaps we'll talk about that another time. Norman Podhoretz, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you for having me.
We've been talking with Norman Podhoretz. The new book is The Norman Podhoretz Reader, a selection of writings from the 1950s through the 1990s, edited by Thomas Jeffers. Jack Beatty, wow, it's a view that has got a lot of legs in the saddle.
It does, and it's also at risk. As you say, many people think this is a neoconservative war, and 500 Americans nearly have died in it, 3,500 casualties, billions of dollars. In a sense, neoconservatism is on trial here, and the verdict is not in from the public or from people at large.
Can America ride along, sort of straddling these views, Jack, for how long?
Oh, I think for a long time, that's what makes us great. We don't settle. Culture is an ever-lengthening quarrel. It doesn't just become one thing.
Cultural and politics, the election looms. Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, On Point's audio archaeologist looks back at a landmark jazz concert. This is On Point. Sixty-six years ago tomorrow, in the winter of 1938, Benny Goodman brought his swing band to the bastion of serious music, the stage at Carnegie Hall. A raucous, provocative, and wildly successful night followed. Jazz had a newfound respectability as America was coming to see this new fusion of African and European influences as its own music, its own unique contribution to global culture. On Point's audio archaeologist Ned Connors digs up sounds and stories from the past for our program. Tonight, Ned takes us back to Benny Goodman's big night in January 1938.
The mood was tense backstage at Carnegie Hall on the evening of January 16, 1938. Benny Goodman and his orchestra were riding high as the nation's most popular swing band and regulars on the Let's Dance radio program. A few months earlier, 29-year-old radio star and bandleader Benny Goodman had been persuaded to take his 16-piece swing orchestra to Carnegie Hall, New York City's hallowed showcase of serious music. It wasn't the first time that jazz, a music born of street marches and dance, had been presented at a sit-down concert. W.C. Handy brought African jazz and blues to Carnegie Hall in 1928, but that was a self-conscious attempt to see the music in a new light, to inject some respectability when disreputable associations with New Orleans brothels and mob speakeasies were still fresh. Goodman, riding the peak of his popularity, sensed a risk in bringing dance music to Carnegie. Goodman walked out on stage to a standing room only audience. He opened with his signature tune, Don't Be That Way, and the explosion of applause made it clear that the night was theirs. On music critic Irving Colladen's suggestion that the concert present a thumbnail history of jazz, Goodman's arrangers put together a 15-minute medley that included a rendition of the original Dixieland Jazz Band's 1919 sensation Rag. For all their musical sophistication, the Goodman Band could still play in the old New Orleans style. Toward the end of the concert, Goodman pulled out an arrangement of Louis Prima's 1936 Sing, Sing, Sing. The song had been evolving over a few years of the band's live shows, and coupled here with another 1930s pop tune, Christopher Columbus, it bore little resemblance to Prima's original. But this minor key romp, best known for drummer Gene Krupa's athletic jungle beat, left plenty of room for Goodman and a soloist to have some fun. The piano player in Goodman's orchestra that night was Jess Stacy. A little older than most of his bandmates, he heard Mississippi Riverboat Jazz firsthand and was himself playing piano and calliope on these excursions by the early 20s. After a stint in Chicago, he came to New York and joined Goodman in 1935. In the sequence of solos in Sing, 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 Stacy found himself following the tenor sax of Babe Rusin, the trumpet of Harry James, and Goodman himself. Each soloist succeeded in building the frenzy of the arrangement and the excitement of the audience. But something completely unexpected happened as Goodman finished his solo. Jess Stacy could have tried to keep up with the brass and reeds, but instead chose, to Goodman's delight, to quietly explore the history of jazz piano, from Barrel House to the first rumblings of the modern sounds that would transform jazz over the next few decades. The orchestra was hushed. Krupa quietly kept the beat. In these 2 minutes, we hear the technique of Earl Hines, the Barrel House style of James P. Johnson, the classical shadings of Eric Satie and Stravinsky, all pieced together in one of the most renowned solos in the history of jazz. You can hear the delight of the audience as Goodman, sensing that something remarkable was happening, pulls his microphone close to the piano and gives Stacy the signal to take it wherever it goes. To my ears, the Stacy solo not only looks back at the roots of jazz, but also foreshadows the direction it will take in the 50s and 60s, putting an exclamation point on an event known as a turning point in jazz history. Here's a recording of Bill Evans 25 years later in the continuum of jazz. We're lucky to have a recording of Goodman's Watershed 1938 concert. He hadn't planned to record it. All these years later, there's still some question as to how it happened, but it appears that Albert Marks, the husband of Goodman vocalist Helen Ward, took it upon himself to hang a single microphone in the rafters and send the concert over wire to a nearby studio where acetate discs were cut. After the concert, one set of the discs was sent to the Library of Congress. The other set was consigned to a closet at Goodman's New York apartment and forgotten. When Goodman moved out in 1950, his sister-in-law, who was moving in, found them. By this time, magnetic tape had come along, and Goodman had the fragile one-of-a-kind acetates transferred. That same year, Columbia released an LP of the concert's highlights, including all 12 minutes of Sing, Sing, Sing. The complete 1938 Carnegie Hall concert remains one of the best-selling and most important jazz recordings of all time. Released twice on CD, this afterthought of a recording is still in print. Jess Stacy's ruminations on jazz piano and his foreshadowing of the cool, cerebral 50s style of Bill Evans, McCoy Tyner, Tommy Flanagan are as fresh today as they were on a January night 66 years ago.
Ned Connors is On Point's audio archaeologist. He lives in Barrington, Rhode Island. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amata, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog. With help today from Michael Garth and Jim Moses, our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.